Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, and on today's episode, Ivan Orkin is a lifelong Gaijin, an outsider, or actually is he, a Long Islander with Jewish roots who found his place and people in Tokyo, became a ramen master, moved himself and his restaurant back to New York City, still sometimes feels like a foreigner. Well, the Gaijin Cookbook, co-authored with Chris Ying, aims to address all that and make you eat more Japanese and be open to anything in the way that the Japanese really are. So from teriyaki to sukiyaki, okonomiyaki to tamaki, all the akis, I guess, Orkin hopes to bring his brand of Gaijin cuisine to prominence from his home to yours. So welcome, Ivan, Chris. Let's define this term. Well, first of all, do either of you really consider yourselves Gaijins, or has that term changed over the years?
I don't think there's much of a choice. This is not an option.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
No, it's just, I mean, when we're talking in relation to Japan, there's the Japanese and then there's everybody else.
You've given a couple different definitions of this word, though, in the book, and one of it is outsider, foreigner, and then something that implies an intruder. What is the, you know, brevity of all those things?
Well, I mean, I think that foreigner or outsider is more of like a literal translation, when like the connotation is that you're more of an intruder, right? Like Gaijin is something people call you derogatorily. And Ivan has been called that for decades, probably sometimes in jest and sometimes with malice, right?
And the last few years, I think that Japan has truly internationalized. It's something you would have expected to have happened 30 years ago, but I think it wasn't quite that quick. So I think, you know, when I first went to Japan in 1987, which is, I guess, a really long time ago, 32 years ago, I think seeing a foreigner was still not that common. And I think, you know, the Japanese, I really don't think I think it's more about liking to control things and liking to be able to, be able to give, let's say a customer comes into a store or a restaurant, you know, be able to speak to them, communicate them, give them the kind of service that they want to. And if they can't communicate, they're uncomfortable. But it is a homogenous society, right? And I mean, it's really mostly Japanese people in Japan.
I mean, what was the intent of calling it the Gaijin Cookbook? Was it to expose that, to push it into a more euphemistic tone?
No, I mean, I don't think we're trying to... I would never think that what we did with this cookbook could affect Japanese culture or Japanese perceptions of outsiders in that way. I think it was just, this book is, Ivan likes to call it kind of like a diary of the way he and his family eat at home. And the fact that it's called the Gaijin Cookbook is because we're approaching it as truly what Ivan and now I cook at home all the time, and the truth about who Ivan is and who we are writing a book about Japanese food is that we are outsiders. We are Gaijin. And so, you know, it's not so much trying to do anything with that term. We're not trying to like reappropriate that term or anything, but just to be very clear about the perspective that we are coming from. And, you know, especially right now, and we talk about this in the book a little bit, this being such a challenging time for people to figure out how to share their cultural traditions, how to partake in other people's cultural culinary traditions. We wanted to kind of add our voice to that conversation a little bit in calling it this Gaijin Cookbook.
You have these tenets in the book, and one of them's being open to anything, which is particularly Japanese, though, you know, a lot of people don't understand that perception. Can you explain what open to anything means and why Western Yoshoku cuisine even exists in Japan?
Well, Well, I mean, the Japanese are clearly experts in borrowing, appropriating, finding things that they like, and then bringing it into their culture. Sometimes it's more successful than others, right? Meaning that, like, they might take cuisine that's normally quite spicy, and then they dumb it all the way down to being almost sweet, and you kind of look at it and go, oh, that doesn't look like anything that I, you know. But then there's other things that they'll take a schnitzel, and all of a sudden it's a tonkatsu, and everybody in the whole world can't eat enough of them, but if you say, do you want a schnitzel? They'll be like, no, I've never had one. I don't really want a schnitzel. But if you say, do you want a tonkatsu? They'll be like, oh, I love that. I had that in a sandwich last week. It was so good, you know? So the it was interesting. And Chris and I had a lot of fun exploring this whole notion of yoshoku or Western cuisine. And that so many people eat things in Japan and they don't realize that they're not Japanese. They're from somewhere else. And then over time, they've sort of become perceived as Japanese.
I remember going to a yoshoku place in Ginza specifically for omurice. And when you go into a place like that, it feels a little bit like a diner because it has an exhaustive menu, a lot of things that maybe seem westernized, but they aren't traditionally diners. You wrote a nice little piece in this book about the vanishing diners of Japan.
Right. And when I was a young man and teaching English in Japan, I used to go to those places, and they were everywhere. They've since been replaced mostly with family restaurants run by giant companies, and they're similar but less homey. But it used to be, you know, you'd go to this quote unquote Japanese diner where they, you know, you got your pro. I mean, it was almost like the what is it? The Southern one and three. What
meat and three. Yeah.
Meat and three. You get your little piece of fish. You get some pickles. You get a little cooked vegetable. You'd get a little bowl of miso soup and a bowl of rice and some nori to roll it all up in. And that became what I ate all the time because I knew what I wanted. My Japanese was still a little, you know, wasn't great yet. And I was a little shy, and they had only 12 things. It was easy to choose. I could read the menu, but they were always very comforting. And you know, I grew up in a family without food comfort. You know, my mother said that if they had a pill, she could eat in the morning and then not have to eat. That would be her dream. So that's what I was contending with. So you know, a lot of my comfort food is that type of food. You know, a grilled piece of mackerel with a bowl of miso soup and some rice and a little pickle, and that to me is when I totally relax.
Yeah, but this isn't a comfort food book. Like, Chris, from your perspective, learning this through the lens of Ivan, what kind of cuisine, what is the umbrella of Gaijin cuisine to you?
Well, you know, I think that there's this idea of having an outsider's perspective is really interesting to me because you can be intrusive as an outsider, as like that term implies, Gaijin implies, is that you're kind of like bumbling through and causing a scene. But there's also something to be said for being a respectful and admiring outsider, like Ivan has been, and a student of this food for decades. And you see things when you have this like respect and curiosity where, you know, maybe people who have grown up eating this every single day don't see the exact same thing or don't see all of the angles from which you can value this stuff. And like Ivan said, like he would go to these teishoku restaurants and be able to eat there for cheap as like a young post-grad college kid who like didn't know, you know, up from down yet, didn't have money and could immerse himself in that way. And because he was a gaijin, he went there and was able to eat there. And in return, those meals, those like formative meals of simple food, made him feel at home. And so like, you know, I don't think if there's an overarching thing to this book, it's just, trying to look at these things that can maybe even be taken for granted as Japanese in Japan, whatever, from this outsider perspective. And I think that the interesting stuff about that yoshoku stuff is, Japan has this reputation as being this closed off, very isolated culture. And so a lot of the literature and cookbooks about Japanese food are treated with this kind of unbelievable reverence and like, oh, it's very precious stuff. Like you cannot break with this or that, or, you know, it has to be done this way. And, you know, the full moon has to rise over Mount Fuji. And, you know, like it's not that way. And like, I think to think that Japanese culture is closed off or they're not open to bringing in outside influences kind of a disservice to like to the people there. And That was what was really interesting, whether it's making ketchup spaghetti or things that are more familiar, like tempura or anything.
Ketchup spaghetti is the greatest thing ever invented.
It is truly the best. Man. It's so good.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, we'll talk about that towards the latter end of this episode.
I think simply speaking, the Gaijin cookbook, the term Gaijin is really just saying, hey, I'm a Gaijin. I lived in Japan off and on for 30 some odd years. I was always held at arm's length, even when I was very famous and successful. I still never was totally slotted in. And my book is basically a journal of how I've lived my life as a person very enamored of Japan. And, you know, my family is Japanese. You know, my children are half, and my wife is from Japan, and my in-laws, and I'm very close with everybody. And I've just lived this very oddly. I mean, I have to say, I'm not in a weird way, but I'm sort of in some ways more Japanese than I am American in certain ways. In other ways, I mean, I'm a loudmouth New Yorker. I talk too loud, too fast, too crazy, and I can be a jerk sometimes. But I'm in food wise, you know, all the things that work for me in that respect, and also culturally, even like Jewish. I'm very Jewish, and yet, you know, in our house, like New Year's Eve is the more spiritual, reverential holiday than Passover is or Rosh Hashanah. You know, it's because I really understand it, and it's so interesting that, you know, a food is a very important part of the culture, and because food is so important to me, and I understand, you know, once you put anything with food, for me, my interest obviously spikes, and it's easier for me to get my head around things when food is related to it.
Well, it's this reference, which you've both now mentioned, that also makes the term otaku so important. You know, the reverence to the craftsperson, to the shokunin who's making these ingredients. And do you think it's because of that depth that you also were able to write a book like this? Because not just any gaijin who just is an outsider there and experiences X, Y, and Z and comes home and cooks can have the voice and the perspective and, you know, the wherewithal that you have for this book.
Well, I think more than anything, it's just that I've, you know, no matter what you want to say, I've really spent the better part of my adult life, you know, living some type of Japanese lifestyle. So it's, you know, as far as otaku, you know, geeky, nerdy, you know, obsessive behavior, I certainly have plenty of that. I mean, I opened a ramen shop in Tokyo. I mean, I was a complete ramen geek, and I, you know, and all my friends who ran ramen shops were geeks, and we did all the crazy geeky things to make the perfect bowl of ramen. But what's fun is that the book isn't—it's not stuck in that one thing. And what Chris was saying earlier, that, you know, there are a lot of books, and I think there's lots of really cool books about Japanese cooking out there. I wanted to write one with Chris that was a little bit more playful, a little bit more relaxed, and a little more real. And because at the end of the day, I'm a real house husband. I really, you know, I go home. My wife knows that. I mean, I'm just like this little Jewish old lady. I just really good at running the house. I'm good at like shopping and putting things together and cooking. And I come home and I'll come home at 5:45. My wife's like, "So what's for dinner?"
Yeah.
So I'm running around. You know, I got carrots and onions in the microwave, and I got the curry box, and I got, you know, and I pull out the frozen pork shoulder that I cooked 3 weeks ago, and I thaw it, and I make curry rice from a box, and my whole family is thrilled because they love it, and I'm happy that I got real food on the table, and I whack out a quick salad, and you know, it's and I'm feeding my family real food.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of important thing. Is there are so many terms to describe that otaku or like shokunin, or I'm just gonna keep mispronouncing everything.
Shokunin, it's shokunin. Two words.
Shokunin. This aspect of Japanese culture that I think so many Western cooks and chefs and you know, general Westerners appreciate is this crazy dedication to one thing. You know, whether it's ramen or soba or sushi or building houses without using nails or whatever it is, like, this is the thing that stands out to so many people, is this artisan dedication. But in our book, it's one section dedicated to four or five recipes that really require a little bit more work than the other ones. And to Ivan's point, like, it's only part of what it is to be Japanese or to live in Japan or to be from that culture. Like, not everybody is like that. There are people, like, the Japanese experience encompasses, you know, the same range as an American one. You know, like, there are people who are busy and need to get food on the table quickly, and that's why Japanese boxed and packaged foods are so good, because, like, convenience and quickness is really important. So yes, like, otaku stuff is part of the book, and, you know, we teach you how to make you know, gyoza and wrap them and do all of that stuff, but it's also, hey, this is also, here are six hacks on how to get, like, a really, really great bowl of curry on the table on the weekdays. And it, you know, involves braising some pork shoulder on the weekend and putting it up for, put it in the freezer, and then, you know, microwaving vegetables to get them a head start. And so, like, that was a really important part for me, was not trying to box in this culture as one thing, and, like, not making it all about otaku or
anything. And maybe dispelling the myths of, or the fear of, it being complex.
Totally.
Yeah, and the fact is that I can tell you right here and now that if you buy 5 to 7 things on Amazon, and I wrote this book with Chris making sure that everything except for mentaiko was the only thing that I had trouble finding which is the spicy cod eggs. But that everything else was on Amazon, and a lot of it's quite reasonably priced. And if you have that pantry, man, I made Mexican food this weekend. I got a bunch of new Mexican cookbooks, and I've been, like, playing around. I had a dinner party, and I decided to make, and I was like, oh, crap, my pantry stinks for Mexican food. And I had to run out, and then I was up in the burbs where I live, so there wasn't any really good Mexican shops, so I had to settle for some ingredients that weren't quite right. And so, I mean, if you want to cook anybody's cuisine, or any new cuisine, then you're going to have to build a pantry. You can't piss and moan about it. It's just what you have to do.
I mean, in New York City, you have Katagiri, Dainobu, Jersey Mitsua. There's access to these things. Yeah. I guess it's that fear of cookability, because ramen got exported here, and people know instant ramen, so they can easily do that. Teriyaki, even before that. What are the ideas that hadn't been exported here that you might have to convince somebody a little more of trying for the first time in this book?
Well, Ivan and I have had a couple of long conversations in the last, you know, day about this very thing, where it's easy for us to forget the bubble that we live in. Like, even if you can find those ingredients on Amazon really easily, or, you know, I live in San Francisco, Ivan lives in New York. Excuse you, Ivan. it doesn't really represent everybody's perspective, and we really want to share this with people who haven't eaten at, like, the best sushi restaurants, or haven't been to Tokyo, or aren't deeply versed with Japanese cuisine. And it was interesting, you know, like, Ivan was, I'm just gonna throw them under the bus, like, Ivan was on the Today Show this morning, you know, talking about this book, and it really, the way that they talked about what he could and could not do on the show, like, don't do any, no raw anything. It can't just be temaki, which are, you know, like, we have this awesome recipe in the book that, like, my in-laws now do every single week for a temaki party, which is just the easiest way to serve, like, sushi at home, instead of rolling everybody's sushi or forming everything.
Taco,
like,
Tuesdays all over.
It's Taco Tuesdays with seaweed and sushi rice and fixings. And it was really eye-opening to think about our own failure of empathy for people who are really unfamiliar with this and are uncomfortable with things that are unfamiliar to them.
Well, but that's really the whole, one of the reasons the book, and Chris and I discussed, you know, probably 6 months before we, you know, pitched the book and got a deal, we started saying, you know, we enjoyed working together before, you know, he slowed down a little bit. He had some time, I had some time, and we started talking about doing another book together. And we talked about a lot of different ideas. And this idea came together that, you know, I would say that most Americans know Japanese flavor. Most. Certainly not all. But people know that flavor of mirin and sake, a little katsuobushi flavor. Like, they just know the basic Japanese flavors. But I think for many people, the thought that they could make something at home that tastes familiar to them, it's very frightening. and you know, they or if they think sushi, they're like, well, I don't like raw fish, I don't want to have that. It's like, well, no, you don't have to. It's so cool. You can leave out the raw fish, and you just cook things. And you know, we do tamaki. When I was younger, I would do tamaki parties in Tokyo, and I didn't have any money. So you know, we had one or two kinds of raw fish, and then I would cook up some sweet pork, and we'd have an avocado and some cucumbers, and you know, and we would stretch it. And it tasted great. And so if you don't like raw fish, you know, you just don't have to eat it.
Actually, my favorite ingredient in the whole book, and I hope this gets elevated in everybody's pantry, is sazukuri, the candied sardines.
Oh yeah. Don't hold your breath.
No, but I think it is about changing the perception. I did an event, I guess it was earlier this year, where I got sukadane from Aichi, and we made sukadane egg and cheeses. And everyone thought it was just bacon because it's just candied and sweet meat.
Right. So, that's a good point, though. It's like these flavors are not necessary. They're not new. And you don't have to even be familiar with Japanese flavors. But like some of these things, like candied sardines are super savory, sweet. Like it's stuff Americans already go crazy for. Like smoky. Like we love all of these things. Like there are universally loved flavors, and this is just other ways to tap into those things that we really, really like. And the core, you know, a lot of the recipes in this book are based on like a very simple, like, you know, katsuobushi, soy, mirin, sake, right? Maybe some sugar. And like that combination in different proportions is just,
it's the whole book.
It's fundamentally delicious.
It's the whole book. And it's just, I just dream for people. Look, at the end of the day, the whole Ivan Ramen thing even is really more about, it's as much about my desire to share how much I love Japan with the world as it is about just me, you know, being a restaurateur or me wanting to make money. I mean, you're making money, you have to. And I enjoy business. But I also truly love Japan, and sometimes I'm disappointed how intimidated people are by Japan, or how people, I meet very well-traveled people all the time who say, you know, their dream is to go to Japan. And I'm like, well, that's just unbelievably absurd comment. You know, I mean, you've been to Paris 6 times this year, but you dream of going to Tokyo someday. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not like going, you know, to the Congo. I mean, it's one of the world's biggest economies, and it's very easy. And people are just a little intimidated by Japan. And
maybe I need to make a Congolese cookbook next. Maybe to dispel your prejudices about going to
Congo. I do not have any prejudice, but I suppose going into the Congo would take a little more bandwidth than going to Tokyo. It wasn't, you know, here you go. Here we go.
I'm just saying they don't call it the Congo anymore.
Oh, what else? All right, so I'm old.
All right. We'll talk about it.
We're in Brooklyn here, man. I'm just trying to keep us on the right side of history here.
What do we call it?
Democratic Republic of the Congo.
All right.
Just Congo.
All right. DRC. We're going to take a quick break, talk about Heart of Darkness, and we'll be right back.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Are you enjoying this show? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. I'm Luke Griffin, and I'm the host of Bushwick Podcast. Each week, we share the remarkable stories of how artists, activists, and entrepreneurs collide in Bushwick, a special Brooklyn neighborhood that's changing faster by the day. You can find Bushwick Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And welcome back to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkill, here today with Ivan Orkin, Chris Ying, and the Gaijin Cookbook. And I want to talk about, you know, how to make the proper pot of rice, sushi rice, how to have these tamaki parties, how to do the basics, the fundamental things. But I want to talk about, do you like using the word fusion? These latter recipes of bagels and sandwiches, and as you mentioned before, mentaiko spaghetti. Where do those lay in the lexicon of being a gaijin?
Well, fusion is a crap-ass word. I mean, I just hate it because it's got... In the 90s, you know, when nobody understood the idea of blending cultures and cuisines, they would call it fusion, but it was often done very poorly and clunky. And if you want to really talk about appropriation, which I don't, you know, it's this notion of just not even knowing what the hell you're doing, just grabbing stuff and mixing. And I think that, you know, the stuff you see there, you know, which is the whole book. It's things that have grown out of me just being me and making things. Some of the stuff I made up, some, you know, the bagel with shiso gravlax. I mean, it makes sense. It's a little bit of a chefy idea.
Or just like the Ayanori cream cheese.
Cream cheese, which is really good.
Yes.
I think we might have done that. We did a breakfast program at Slurp Shop for about 6 months. That was spectacular. It never really caught on, and we got rid of it after a while. But I did a whole bagel thing, and with the gravlax salmon, and it was really good.
You gave me this amazing recipe for my book, Acid Trip, all about vinegar, and it was a pickled herring batera with Acme smoked fish herring. And I thought at first it was just you combining your Jewishness with your Japanese, you know, nuances. It's more than that. It's deeper. I mean, that works for a reason. And
well, it's a batera.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't make it up. They did. I mean, it's a holy Japanese thing. And once again, that's why, to me, I'm very ambivalent about this whole discussion of me, of like, I just met someone the other day who said, I just love the way you use your Jewishness in your food. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful, man. And I'm like, I don't know, but it's like, I'll never call myself an artist because I don't really believe in that stuff. I see myself, if anything, as an artisan or a craft person. I use my hands. Mm-hmm. But most creatives, you know, Chris too in his writing. I'm sure the more Chris reads, the more he reads something that's inspiring to him, then maybe some of that stylistically seeps into his writing, or he writes something in a phrase that he might not have written before. But as creatives, you get exposed to things and they creep into your brain and you end up, but it's not because you go, oh my God, I love being Jewish and I love rye. I'll use rye. Yeah, now I'm rye. I'm a Jewish guy. You know, it's like, no, you just, you start to understand ingredients from experiences. And sure, I ate a lot of rye bread when I was a kid and I happened to like the flavor of rye, but it's more that I'm a chef and I understand that rye has a lower gluten content than other kinds of wheat, and it made a lot of sense as an addition to a noodle recipe, and that's how I ended up using it. And in the batera, it's the same thing. I mean, you know, having pickled fish on top of seasoned rice that you press down and have this little bite of compact sushi is something they've been doing in Osaka for a long time.
But you have these references. You have these points in your life that you can draw from. How do you convince somebody to cook a pot of rice, sushi rice, who's never necessarily thought of that as something substantive, as something, you know, that takes technique, that takes time, that takes patience? Like, Chris, where do you draw from to write about cooking the perfect sushi rice?
Well, let me segue into that. But I would just say on the fusion thing, like the term itself, like my the difficulty I have with the term fusion is, like, there's this implication that when you fuse two things together, they don't naturally come together. Yeah, there's this action to it. There's this, like, I've got to solder these two things that don't belong together. And the other problem with this idea of fusion is that it separates food that is quote-unquote fusion from food that is not fusion, when there is no difference. All food is fusion food. All food is the combination of other, like, two different cultures, three different cultures, 50 different cultures coming together to make this one thing. So, like, I don't object to the term fusion, except that draw me the line between what's fusion and what's not. And, you know, I say that, and I say there's this, like, there's this natural process to creating cuisine, while at the same time, like you said, we're asking people to come out of their comfort zone a little bit and say, oh, I've thought of rice as a thing I care about making. I've never cared about making the perfect pot of Japanese rice. I've never given much thought to the proportions of water and you know, soaking rice first or whatever it is, the vessel I'm cooking rice in. And so Yes. Cuisine happens best through these collisions, through Ivan absorbing influence, and whether or not he's consciously using his own experiences and making these new things happen or not. Like there's this natural thing that happens. But with this book, we are asking people to meet us halfway to some extent, to give a little more thought to a super simple thing like rice. And that's why
it's also showing them that, like, in our culture, right, in American culture, if we were discussing bread, especially in New York, where I think bread and sandwiches are really important for most of us, no matter where you've come from. If you live in New York long enough, you kind of get into the sandwich culture. And, you know, you could wax poetic about bread. Anybody will. You'll start talking about it, and they get it. So rice is the same thing. Like, rice in Japan and in most of Asia, you know, properly cooked, delicious rice is really important to people. And the difference between good rice and bad rice is profound, and it's bothersome when it's not right.
But even on a more simple level than that, it's like the recipes in this book use short grain Japanese rice because, like, that's what
right
tastes better. Like, it doesn't, like, the same dishes on top of long grain jasmine rice just don't taste as good.
Well, it's just not Japanese.
That's just like, well, it just doesn't, I mean, I think objectively it doesn't taste as good to have these
No, I agree. Well, it's because the Japanese have never used aromatic mm-hmm. long grain rice.
So just like that basic amount of thought that, like, hey, you should have more than one kind of white rice in your pantry is, like, probably going to be an interesting revelation for most people outside of this room, you know, like... That it matters. That's like that's an important point. It's just that it matters.
But that pot of rice, again, is so foundational that it opens the door for so many things too. From, you know, simple onigiri to ochazuke, which is one of my favorite ways to, you know, enjoy rice and tea during the fall time. But then you have so many rice dishes. Oyakodon, you know, the parent and child chicken and egg dish, and we see these things as these singular, almost autonomous terms or dishes, but really, foundationally, it comes right back to being able to cook rice.
Yes, and it's not that hard. And, you know, I've had a rice cooker most of my adult life. You know, and most people have some type of machine these days, so you can pull off rice and those things if you YouTube it. But you can I even talk about the knuckle method, you know, where you have one knuckle from the tip of your finger touching the rice to the top of your first knuckle, the water should stop.
This is my least favorite method that I've been taught since
I was a kid. Yeah, well, it depends on the size of your hand, too.
I believe it or not, I didn't know this, Chris, for a really long time. And I don't know, I learned it not that long ago. But since I learned it, I do it. I mean, it's when I do the rice cooker, I just go by the lines because I have a rice cooker.
Yeah.
But when I make it in a regular pot, and if you want to get geeky, if you want to be an otaku, then I recommend you go out and buy one of those double lidded, mm-hmm. clay pots, which really you can tell the difference.
Yeah. And are you pushing people to go out and get a donabe?
Absolutely not. No, because look, I think that people know how they want to be in the kitchen. And I think that, you know, our book, by having an otaku recipe chapter and by having all these different discussions, there is an opportunity for people to delve in deeper and try things that are harder. But I think the point we also make is that, hey, we know that you guys got a lot of stuff going on. And I do too, and Chris does too. He has a little child. I have... two big children that shouldn't be in the house, but they are. And I have to feed them every day. And so, trying to help people have Japanese flavors in their home without having to, go take a 6-week class.
Sukune. I don't remember whether or not the recipe says sukune first or chicken meatballs first, but which way do you hope to present that to people and why?
Well, we had hoped to present it as sukune first and then chicken meatballs, but we were overruled.
Yes.
Which is fine, because to some extent, it's a little self-indulgent, right? Like, if it's harder for somebody to get into the recipe because they have no idea what you're talking about when you present the Japanese name first. And again, I'm not talking about people who eat at a yakitori restaurant every week or anything like that. We're talking about the broader reading audience, like... To make it more difficult on them, for our own sake, is maybe something I would have done 6, 7, 8 years ago. we insisted, of course, on presenting both names. Like, we don't want to like erase one over the other or show, but we just wanted to make it accessible. We want to, like, if you're intimidated, and like it or not, the truth is that a lot of people are intimidated by cooking Japanese food at home, and we want to destigmatize that. Then, like, it's too self-serving to just do the thing we thought would be fun.
Okonomiyaki is something similar too. I mean, it's a savory pancake. What are the things that you myth-busted or demystified, and then people realize, oh wow, this is so much easier than I ever thought?
I don't know. I think the tamaki party, I'm telling you, I think that's something that, you know, people don't even. I was explaining it to one of the TV guys this morning on the Today Show, and it took me a few minutes to really explain it to him, because he was like, no. And I was like, he's like, but I don't want to have to roll it. And I was like, no, that's why it's so great, because you're not sitting there in the kitchen rolling after roll while your wife and your friends are having a great time, and then you come out at the end of the night and everybody applauds. You just put everything on the table, right? So tamaki, right, it's a hand roll, and hand roll meaning you fold it over and you have some rice. It could be vinegared rice, sushi rice, or, to tell you the truth, I never used to make vinegar rice. I always used plain rice.
Set the scene a little bit. It's just like everybody gets a little stack of squares of seaweed.
Right.
There's a big bowls, communal bowls of rice, whether it's been seasoned with vinegar or not, depending on how lazy you are. And then whatever fixings, you know, whatever toppings, cucumber and avocado and shiso leaves and ginger and, you know, whatever raw fish that you want, or cooked fish, or your leftover pork from last night, anything that would go with rice, and that's it. And like, people just make their own tamaki. And I think like that is a huge thing that has like demystified sushi. Like I said, like my in-laws, who are not Japanese, eat this every single week, because they're like, this is crazy. We love sushi, and it's amazing that we can do this at home now.
But is it because of the elements that you just mentioned that go into that, the fixins? Or let's take the Oden party, because then you have terminology like, you know, chikuwa, satsuma age, shirataki noodles. Those seem a little more foreign than, you know.
And we put that, so Oden is, I mean, describe Oden.
Oden is mostly fish balls, fish cakes, vegetables, eggs poached in dashi.
And in Japan, like, you know, Ivan and I had an amazing meal in Kyoto where, you know, each different ingredient has its own little copper pot of dashi that it's cooked in. And you eat everything from these homemade tofu and fish cakes to whale or whatever. We put our version of this in the otaku section because it does require a little bit of dedication. And in this case, it requires you to go to a Japanese market and buy these things. We're not asking anybody to make their own fish cakes, but we are asking you to go to the store and like push yourself to like buy some.
And inquire and ask and look. I tell you, any decent Japanese market has, at a minimum, a freezer section with all the Oden fish cakes. And you can buy daikon, and you know, you cook it until it's almost soft. You finish it in the dashi. It's the most wonderful. I mean, it's one of my favorite things in the whole wide world.
Oh, I love it. And I've always been told that it's just old man winter food.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's so heartwarming. It's so hearty. And it's not simplistic in that the things that you put in it are you know, very well made. I mean, they come from Shokunin, the chikuwa fish cakes, and
well, it just depends. I mean, you know, remember, or I will remind you that you can get an okay bowl of oden at any 7-Eleven from the middle of October until the middle of April, and it's not bad. And you know, so that's where you start. And then, like Chris said, we went to a place in Kyoto where they made every single thing by hand, and it was such an experience because everything we ate, you could tell was made by hand. It was so beautifully prepared, and the dashi was so clean and perfect, and it was just so it's so interesting because the spectrum, it's so broad, you know.
Well, I mean, let me ask you this, the spectrum of the perfect onsen egg, can you get that everywhere now, that jamminess that everyone expects, or is there perfection, is there latitude to it? I mean, when you go out to a Japanese restaurant and you have that onsen egg, how good or bad can it be?
Well, I mean, onsen tamago is an onsen tamago. I mean, once you know how to make it, it's basically, I mean, maybe we're talking about, you know, in Japan, for any of those of you who have been there, know that eggs in Japan are pretty spectacular, and they're not quite as good in the States to being really pretty crappy. Now, I'm sure there's other countries around the world that also have spectacular eggs that I'm not familiar with, but the eggs in Japan are particularly special. So in that respect, yes, in onsen tamago that you had in Kyoto is probably going to be one of your grand memories, and I don't know if you'll repeat it. But I tell people, even in our first book, I said, look, man, I mean, I'm telling you how to make ramen. You know, it'll get pretty close to what I make at the restaurant because I'm giving you the recipe, but... that's why the restaurant business is so hard, because you know there's so many factors, or when you cook at home, you have a fight with your wife, your kid's being a pain in the neck, you know, the power goes out. I don't know what the hell goes on. I mean, things affect cooking.
Well, what are the most inelastic recipes in this book?
Well, here's how I think the progression should work for somebody, or what we would hope would happen is, okay, maybe you've gone to a Japanese restaurant, you've had onsen tamago, you know, you've had this quote unquote hot spring egg that's basically like a egg poached in its own shells is how I would describe it. And you're like, oh, I love that. Or I love okonomiyaki, or I love teriyaki, or whatever, something you know. And you see it in our book. And they're like, they are inelastic recipes. Like you make an onsen tamago, like Ivan said, like there's not a lot of wiggle room. Like once you've dialed in, like how long it takes to cook this thing and turn out a certain way, it is what it is. But let's say, okay, I've learned how to do this thing. I've learned how to make these familiar things that are in this book and that are pretty, you know, black and white as to how they're done. Then you see, you trust us. You trust that we've showed you how to make this thing. And then you're like, what is oden? You know, like, I've never been to Japan. I've never had this thing. But, like, trust these guys. Maybe I will, next time I'm at this Japanese market, I'll go and buy a bunch of fish cakes and make some dashi and cook it and eat it with some mustard and daikon and, like... crap, this is amazing. Shit, like, this is a delight. And like, that will open your eyes to other things. And maybe you'll finally take that dream trip to Japan and you'll find yourself in Kyoto and you won't feel so awkward when you see oden in a 7-Eleven or at the nice restaurant. Like, now you have some basis familiarity. And, you know, it's not destigmatizing anything so much as, like, trying to just get people in general to be more open.
But it's experience. Like anything. It's even for me. I've been cooking for almost 30 years, but then I'll get some recipe that I'll find somewhere and I cook something that I don't cook that often, a Russian food, a Mexican dish, whatever it is. And I'll follow the recipe pretty close because maybe I'm not familiar with how it's made. And then when I eat it, I'm like, oh my God, this tastes just like that thing I had in Mexico. I'm like, I can't believe I just made this. You know, I mean, I'm no different. You know, I don't know everything. God, when I know everything, you just kill me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just so there. We're all the same. You know, I mean, even, you know, chefs, there are things. I mean, a lot of chefs like to kind of strut around and act like they know everything, but they don't. And it's to me, I guess, going continuing this with this theme that Chris started, my dream would be for someone to pick a recipe, any recipe, and make it and have them say, oh my God, this recipe really works. And this tasted like that dish I love that I had at the local Japanese place or that I had when I was visiting Japan, and have them just feel that sense of accomplishment. Because like I said, I still to this day, after almost 30 years of cooking, when I cook something new and it tastes really delicious, I am just thrilled beyond, I can't even explain it. I'm just, oh my God, I'm like picturing myself. I'm like, I can't believe I made this. This is so good. Cooking's really fun and it's very liberating. I mean, I started cooking as a youngster because my mother insisted I eat Hungry Man dinners and I just put my foot down and I said, I'm not eating this crap anymore. And I liberated myself. And being able to cook for yourself delicious food that you enjoy is the most wonderful feeling.
You know, I wish you could blurb yourself on the back of the book, because that was like the most ring endorsement I've ever heard.
Yeah, right.
Of someone.
Liberated myself from my mother.
Yeah. Well, we'll do the mommy issue episode another time. And in the meantime, everyone should go out, get the Gaijin cookbook, and like Chris said, take that dream trip to Japan. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you to Hearst as our sponsors, music by Cookies and Matt Patterson Engineering. Cheers. The Food Scene is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.